Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Wonders of the Night Sky You Must See Before You Die by Bob King. We're up to the 18th, and it's called Distorted Moons. Let's read this to you. I must admit, it is sort of astronomical wonders. I just question it all. Okay, the beauty can be many things. A moonrise is one of them. Moonrises also excel at demonstrating how the Earth's atmosphere interacts with and alters the appearance of celestial objects. Unless you're an astronaut, every time you look up the stars, planets, moon and sun, your line of sight passes through miles and miles of air haze. In photos taken from space, the atmosphere looks like an insubstantial bluish mist. But it's critical to keeping us alive and sources so many wonderful astronomical illusions. Twinkling stars, the oval rising moon, sunsets, oranges, reds and oranges, the dimming of stars near the horizon are just a few ways the atmosphere affects how we see the sky. Even the simplest thing, a blue sky, is caused by tiny molecules of the air that scatter away blue light from sunlight and send it bounding across the sky. With blue removed, the sun appears pale yellow to our eyes. Our air thins with altitude, so the higher up you look, the less air you look through. The bottom 10 miles of the atmosphere is called the troposphere. 10 miles. You'd be lucky. It's the top of your atmosphere, the top of the clouds. So I think 10 miles is probably... That's 15. I think that's a bit excessive. It contains 80% of the total atmosphere. That's where the air is densest. A box of air at a metre weighs 1.2 kilograms. That's the level, but only 90 grams. Three kilometres up. When you look at something near the horizon, you gaze across hundreds of miles of the thickest, densest air at the bottom of the atmosphere. The closer the sun and the moon is to the horizon, the more light must pass through before the colours that are scattered away. By sunset, blues and greens are gone, only yellows, oranges and reds are able to pass past the molecules and make it to our eyes. We can't help but remark, what a beautiful sunset. It's some of the dirtiest air littered with natural material like dust, sand, salt, volcanic ash, aromatics released from forest field fires, human-made pollutions such as soot, car exhaust and sulfur dioxide. Except during the large volcanic eruptions, this material typically mutes the colour of the rising and setting sun and moon and dilutes the hours of twilight. Dense air also acts as a prism that bends, refracts the light as it passes through, similar to how the water bends and reflects the light. It's called refraction. Anyone spear hunting a fish will take refraction into account. Light refracting off the fish will come to your eyes, get bent and reflected when it exits the water, leaving it at a different angle from whence it came. If you're not aware of this, you'll always spear at the fish appears to be on where it actually is. Whenever light travels from one medium to another, the denser part of the single medium is the less dense part it's bent. Air near the horizon excels at refracting light, and you can guess why. It's denser air immediately above it. The iconic oval moon at the rise is shaped by refraction. Denser air close to the horizon refracts or lifts up the bottom of the moon more than the top, squeezing it into an oval. The moon looks less squished the higher and higher it climbs the sky because the air along the line of sight thins rapidly and refraction effects lessen. Really, for more weirdness? Ready for more weirdness? Refraction is so strong at the horizon that lifts the entire moon or sun to view before either have actually risen. If you could magically remove the atmosphere, the moment of sun's bottom limb reaches the horizon, our star would suddenly disappear. If then we waited for the real sunrise, again with no atmosphere, the sun would come up perfectly round and glaring white. No pleasing warm hues to greet the day, yet another reason to appreciate the atmosphere it does for us. When you look across many miles of lower atmosphere at the low moon or sun, changes in the air density, shifting winds, turbulence can imprint their own special distortions on their discs, making every rising and setting a unique experience. Turbulence can cause pieces of the moon to peel off and float away, and it's seen best in binoculars, while vibrations in the degree of variations, degree of refraction with the height and temperature inversion can dimple or even cut steps into the rising setting moon. This is actually good photographs of it here. Usually air cools with latitude, but in a temperature inversion, air in the ground water level is colder than the air above, inviting all kinds of weird distortions, including superior images. Seeing these mind-bending phenomena doesn't take fancy equipment. Most are visible with the naked eye, though a few will show best up with binoculars. One of those is the colour effect of dispersion. Earlier, we learned that white light is comprised of all colours of the rainbow. Refraction at the horizon not only lifts up the entire moon wholesale, but the closer inspection through binoculars reveals that each colour is lifted to different degrees, spreading out the lunar disc in the same way a prism spreads out the white light of the rainbow. Blue is bent more than red, so one edge of the moon is fringed with blue and the other shimmers red. Finally, clouds add their own touch of wonder to the rising and setting of the moon. They take on a moon's ruddy colours and form menacing dark streaks across its face. One of my favourites is what I call a lunar bulge. Sometimes, at the top and bottom of the moon disk are hidden by clouds, with the light streaming from a narrow band across the middle. The contrast between light and dark makes the bright bulge out and distorts the moon's shape. Oh, light pillars. Now, that's an interesting thing. I hadn't known that. Chapter 19, Light Pillars. If you don't mind the cold, you'll come to a good seeker of light pillars. They're not always in the form in cold weather. All you really need are high clouds made of ice crystals to see one tower over the moon or the sun. But the most striking, even surreal pillars appear over artificial lights over bitter cold nights. So that's actually, I rather like that. I've seen that. Oh, wow. This is a picture. I haven't seen anything like this in Australia. A light pillar looks like a vertical band of light strand above and sometimes below the sun and moon. It might look like a moon or a sun is shooting a beacon of light into the sky, but nothing could be further from the truth. A pillar isn't a thing, but rather a collection of crystals between you and the light source. If you're out with a friend admiring a light pillar, each of you is seeing a slightly different version of the pillar. And it's beautifully, so beautifully expressed. I wish I could do it. I wish I could write with him. By the way, the same is true for halo phenomena and rainbows. Each is unique to the person's viewpoint. A light pillar, billions of flat hexagonal plate crystals in the cirrostratus clouds drift horizontally, plate side up towards the ground. Wow. I suppose that's what it is. They're horizontal. Light reflects from the bottom sides of all these tiny mirrors and is reflected downward to the observer, who sees a streak of diffuse light arising from the setting sun or moon. Not all light pillars look alike. Really, tall spires form from ice crystals at higher latitudes. The tallest completely change character, appearing as a cluster of short streaks of light radiating from the overhead point of zenith. Narrow, bright pillars form when the crystals are stable in the horizontal plane, neither tipping or tilting, but the more turbulent weather, tilting crystals can make for more feathery columns. The most striking pillars are often seen at sunset and sunrise, moonset, moonrise, when the warm front is approaching, bringing in a veil of high clouds from the western sky. So, that's the entire thing. Those plates, you know, for some reason, in the air, flatten it. I don't understand. It can't be gravity. As gorgeous as the natural light pillars are, poorly shielded artificial lights, the very ones that lessen our view of the night sky, can produce amazing displays of swarthy, colourful pillars. Even car headlights do this. On extremely clear nights, plate crystals can form directly in the air, in diamond dust. Illuminated by yard and street lights, they create a phantasmagorical scene of multiple sparks of the night pointing towards a skyward like some ice crystal aurora. If the temperature is below minus 12 degrees, the ice fog and snow is forecast. Make a point to go out and look for the phenomena. never seen in Australia. Driving home one night when the temperature stood at minus 12 degrees C, I noticed flecks of snow in my headlight beam. Once I got away from city lights, all oncoming cars were decorated with double sets of tails and narrow high pillars created by the headlights. Because the pillars stood so high, I could easily tell when the car was approaching well before the headlights flashed into view. One night, a friend called me to alert a fantastic display of northern lights visible directly over the city of Duluth, Minnesota. I ran out to look and saw an amazing sight of light pillars, diamond dust, up to its old tricks again. They're not northern lights, are they? A bright meteor shower. Chapter number 20. I have seen there's some beautiful meteors. I haven't actually seen what I call a shower. Now, Cassiopeia is that big W. The Pleiades, this is the northern hemisphere that we've shown. Every night I'm out under the stars, I hope to see a fireball. I suppose if I just sat still reclining in a chair and looked up, the odds would improve. As it is, I mix looking through, observing through a telescope. So my fireball list isn't what it could be. Still, I rarely return indoors meteorless. A fireball is a term given to a meteor as bright as Venus or brighter, and unforgettable ones that elicit the prolonged whoas. According to the American Meteor Society, experienced observers can expect to see one fireball in Venus's brightness every 20 hours of meteorite observing on average. For fireballs of magnitude minus 6, 1.5 times the brightness of Venus, the time increases to 200 hours. Clearly, they're not common. And this is why many of us allow meteorite watching with annual meteor showers. Meteor showers occur when the Earth passes through the tail of dust left behind a comet, or, more rarely, an asteroid. Particles called meteoroids arrange between 0.4 and 0.4 inches, 1 millimetre to centimetre across, an average distance between them of 18 to 25 miles in a dense shower. A typical meteor-making meteoroid, the name given to a space debris before it strikes Earth's atmosphere, is the size of a single breadcrumb. And the distance between each nugget amounts to a 20-minute drive on a freeway. Despite nifty illustrations, meteorite showers are thin soup. But speed makes all the difference. Earth is moving at more than 30 kilometres per second around the sun. The meteorite stream roars along the similar speed. When a planet tears through the debris, it completes a 32-kilometre drive in about a second. Scarfing up a healthy number of meteorites in a surprisingly short period of time. Speed matters in astronomy. If it took the chocolate chip and I threw it at you, you'd probably hardly feel it. Take the same chip at the speed of 114,000 kilometers per hour, the average encountered speed of the linear meteor shower meteoroid, it would feel like a bullet. Speed increases the object's kinetic energy. Also called the energy of motion. The reason why such a small thing like a pebble-sized space rock or a lost screw can damage the hull or crack the window of an international space station as it orbits. The Earth is more than 27,000 kilometers per hour. Because most material shed from a comet is tiny, the majority of shower meteorites are faint, but there are plenty of middle bright ones and almost always a few jaw-droppers. Dozens and dozens of meteorite showers are known, but most are weak with counts of only a few per hour. Of these, nine of the major meteorite producers, with rates ranging from 10 per hour to the Ursids up to 120 per hour for their Geminades and Quadrants. Shower names are based on constellations from which the meteorites appear to radiate, hence the Leonids, Leo, Geminids, Gemini, and so on. Quadrants are the name of unique belonging to a now-defunct constellation of Ursula Major, the Great Bear, and Bootes, a herdsman called the Quadrants, Murus, after Mural Quadrant, whatever that means. Of the major meteorite showers, the richest, most reliable, and easiest to view are the Perseids, which radiate from Perseus, just below the W of Cassiopeia in mid-August, and the Geminids, in which December 13th and 14th, and stream from near the bright star Castor above Orion. The perisids produce some 100 meteors per hour under dark moonless skies at peak. The Geminids are currently a rich shower with a maximum of 120 meteors an hour under the same conditions. Remember that near a city, light pollution will cut those numbers in half. Add a bright moon and the numbers halve again. Even though the quadrants produce a rich display, timing has to be near perfect because the peak shower activity lasts only a few hours. If those hours are from 3 p.m. On January the 4th, of your location, you'll see very little. But if the peak occurs shortly before local dawn, when the radiant strands of light in the northern sky, you'll get a great show. Hit and miss best describes this shower. Meteorite showers are best viewed when the radiant constellation is high in the sky as possible. So most peak after midnight in the wee hours. After higher means fewer meteorites cut off by the horizon. All showers send meteors across all directions of the sky, but you can always identify a shower member by tracing its path backwards. If it points back to Perseus, it's a Perseidoid. If not, it's a random sporadic meteorite. Some meteorite showers have outbursts that double or triple their expected outputs. This happens when the Earth passes towards a denser strand of the comet dust laid down hundreds of years early that we're only encountering now in the 21st century. Meteor experts can often predict when these will occur, and you'll find them reported in websites such as astrobob.blog or spaceweather.com. The Leonids shower, which peaks November 17th and 18th, and averaged 15 meters per hour, puts on a much bigger show at the 33-year intervals. That's how long it takes for the parent comet, 55P Temple Turtle, to return to the Earth's sun neighbourhood. The solar heating evaporizes the dust-rich ice from the comet. If the Earth crosses the fresh filament, the meteor storm results. In 1833, the Leonid meteor storm rained meteors over Americas at the rate of more than 100,000 per hour. 33 years later, in 1866, Europe witnessed several thousand per hour. Angus Kirk of the American Astronomers and writer remarked a popular history of astronomy during the 19th century. On the night of the 12th and 13th, 1813, a tempest of falling stars broke over the earth. The sky was scored in every direction with shining tracks and illuminated majestic fireballs. At Boston, the frequency of meteorites was estimated to be about half that of the flakes of snow in an average snowstorm. Michael Schneider, who chronicled events at the Washington Navy Yard, put it more succinctly. The meteors, sick, fell in the elements of the 12th of November, 1833, on Thursday in Washington. It frightened the people half to death. After a hiatus of a century, the showers returned with the ferocity in 1966, briefly snowballing the atmosphere with 150,000 metres an hour. Years 1999, 2001, 2002 were excellent Leonids showers, and 2001 was a standout. That year, my kids and wife and I spread a blanket out in the driveway at 2 a.m. and were delighted to one fireball after another. Hands down, it was the best shower I've ever seen. Will the Leonids kick up another storm in 2033 or 2034? Unfortunately, FP Temple Tuttle heads towards its next perihelion, closest March, in May 2031. It will pass near Jupiter in August 2029. The multi-planet scramble will alter the comet's orbit in a way that will prevent Earth from getting close enough to suck the fresh material of 33 and 34. And in 2065, the likelihood of storms improves in 98, and gets really good at 2131. So at least the great grandkids will thrill to the meteorite spree. The rest of us will just have to take our chances with the reliable annual showers combined with with as much look-up time as we can imagine. So, just checking the time, it's 19 minutes of reading. Just having a check here. So, yeah, I have a rubber band holding in my my plug after having a sort of disastrous nailed that one. Galileo moons. I love the Galileo moons. The 21. So, Jupiter's Galilean moons. I never forget my first encounter with Jupiter in a small telescope. The bright star I'd seen looking for months became a creamy oval disk crossed by dark stripes accompanied by four tiny moons. The transformation so easily accomplished with my little 60mm instrument got me hooked in the Jupiter watching for life. If you like space travel, you'll come naturally to its telescope. They're a poor man's rocket ship to the stars. What a beautiful... I wish I could have... I've just got to really channel this person's writing. Want to visit Jupiter, Mars, distant stars in the Milky Way? Plunk down your scope and aim at launch. Even city dwellers can make good use of telescopes when it comes to bright planets, the Moon, the Sun, because they're mostly unaffected by light pollution. That's especially true of Jupiter, the brightest planet in the night sky after Venus. Despite being almost 500 million miles away, Jupiter's enormous girth, so that's 500 million, and we're 150 million from the Sun, so that gives you a feeling. Despite Jupiter's enormous girth and sunlight reflecting clouds have made it stand out amongst the eight planets. Jupiter is slowly large, 11 times the diameter of Earth. If you could, so that's 11, but then square that, so that's 100 times brighter than Earth. If you could hollow it out like a Halloween pumpkin, every other planet in the solar system could squeeze inside with room to spare. I wish it's a beautiful expression. That's why even a steady-held and sharply focused times 10 pair binoculars will reveal the shape, unlike the pinpoint stars. Perpetual cloud cover also adds to the planet's shiny personality. Clouds affect a lot of the light compared to the groundwater. Jupiter reflects about 50% of the sunlight it receives compared to the Earth's 30%. While our planet has a healthy percentage of clouds, we're all too aware on overcast nights, it's mostly covered by water, with a modest contribution from land. The solar system's largest planet, the largest family of moons, a total of 69 known about from mid-2017, undoubtedly more will be found in coming years. Of the small army, only four are the brightest to see with scopes and binoculars. They're named Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto. And if you learn to say them in order, you'll always know that's the same order of their distance from the planet. Okay. Let's look at Io. Io's average distance is 422,000 kilometres, which is over the Moon distance, so a little more than the Moon's distance from Earth. Callisto orbits 4.6 times further out at 1.2 million miles from Jupiter. All four of similar size to our Moon. Europa is smallest with a diameter of 3,130 kilometres. Ganymede, the largest, with 3,327 kilometres. The Moon is 3,467 kilometres. So they're all a bit under the Moon, but not a lot. Just as Earth completes an orbit around the Sun every single year compared to 12 years it takes to Jupiter, the closer moons circle the giant planet faster than the fastest one. Beautifully put. When Galileo first saw Jupiter, the family through his homemade spyglass-style telescope, he was immediately struck by the scene's resemblance to the solar system in miniature and took it as proof that the Sun must sit at the centre of ours. His revelation was in conflict with the prevailing view of the Earth-centred universe at the time, which got him into trouble with the Catholic Church. But that's another story, and that's actually incorrect. You know, the Catholic Chronicles really open that up, sort of really put that into questions. I just, you know, there's so much I'd like to ask about that. As far as I know, no one gets into trouble for making... people were quite open to discussing it with him. It was a whole heap of other things. Saying that the Pope was an idiot was one thing. As far as I know, no one gets in trouble for making remarks about Jupiter's moon nowadays. Instead, we enjoy visiting the planets in any clear night. It's out to reveal the diverse arrangement and other hijinks. One night, mate, you see all strung out like socks to the laundry line. Another night, just two of them, one hidden behind the planet, the other in front of camouflage Jupiter's cloud. Sometimes they'll gather in little groups, and sometimes they'll spread as far apart like wide open arms. In the hundreds of times I've checked them, I don't think I've ever seen them a repeat. Each moon is unique. Io's surface is pepperonied with, I love it, 400 volcanoes, 150 of which are currently active. And the lava they spew out is rich sulfur, causes the surface of crazy pizza-like hues, an orange and red. In a 6-inch, 152-millimeter larger telescope, the colour resembles a ripe peach compared to the blander hues of the brothers and sisters. Europa, in contrast, is covered with a crust of water ice at least 3 kilometres thick. Beneath it lies a salty ocean estimated to be 100 kilometres deep. That's warm and mineral-rich enough to personality to support simple bacteria. That's why NASA sends its Europa Clipper to study the moon in close-ups sometimes in the 2020s. Of all the bodies in the solar system beyond Earth, Europa may be the one most promising to take for life. Because of Jupiter's greater distance from the Sun, it's much colder there. So why are some of the moons still warm? Flexing. As they orbit Jupiter, Io and Ganymede tug on each other, making the orbit slightly oblong. I don't think you need... You don't need... You have to have I don't think you need that to get tidal heating. I don't know. I think it's just has to rotate tidal heating. Okay. On the far end, the moon relaxes back to a more spherical shape. Repeated flexing creates a lot more internal friction and heats up the partially melts the interior. Water, I suppose, if they're not spinning. Water and magma results from the breaks to the surface as either erupts a volcano or freezes to form icy crust. Similar tugs on Earth flex the moon's crust, while the moon's gravity, often in concert with the sun, flexes the Earth's crust to the tune of 25 centimetres high every time. So it's, you actually lift up. The moon lifts up, but it's, you know, I don't know. It's differential orbits. I think they're really confused. Ganymede is the brightest and largest of Jupiter's moons, and it may also have a salty underground ocean. Because of its greater distance from Jupiter, only Callisto escapes the effect of flexing. Instead of geological activity, the relatively youthful surface is one of the oldest landscapes in the solar system, covered with more craters than any other place we know of, even the moon. While we may see a few of the details that make each moon unique, knowing a little about them will help us illuminate the first night you swing a telescope towards Jupiter and discover the dancing satellites for yourself.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.